is pretty stimulating, but also as a someone who's going to be front into the same sort of situation, teaching biology students as well as physicists and entering frontier biology. I'm glad that you're not just relying on solely, you know, trial and error, trying to solve these problems, but actually trying to get a directed approach of finding a solution. So I'll just start with the observation, sort of the basic premise of, I think, what everyone sort of knows to be true, through dependent conference,
and that's sort of the premise of the rest of the talk, or at least my comments, which Boris told me I should make provocative, so please don't be too insulted.
And the statement is this,
it's just that
with the observation that microscopic properties in biology can have surprising qualitative macroscopic effects. And those effects can be very large, but at the same time, and
be quite independent of many details.
Right? This is sort of the basic premise of a lot of physicists and other mathematical biologists entering the field of biology. So they understand that certain details on the microscopic scale are extremely important, while at the same time, certain other details are and the art of theory in biology would be to understand which of these details are important and which of these can be ignored to get a better principal understanding.
So just as a couple of examples, is that my background is in theoretical neuroscience, and that's what I work on. So one point is just that neuroscience is a lot about recurrent network.
And then...
We have to start over. No.
The evil empire.
Since my background is neuroscience, one of the examples is just in recurrent network theory. So this is just an example of how people understood that very simple learning rules for plasticity between weights, between neurons, driven by correlated inputs can lead to formation of very deep maps in the visual cortex, so that are certain regions represent sensitivity of this part of cortex to bars in the visual space of a certain orientation, and so on. So simple theoretical models just based on correlated inputs and interactions between neurons that actually change over time as a result of these correlations can lead to the formation of these very beautiful and initially, you know, surprising map formation property. A very different field is ecological stoichiometry, and a very interesting but very basic observation in ecological stoichiometry was made by a guy named Redfield, who pointed out that the nitrogen to phosphorus ratio in plankton in the ocean was 16, but the ratio actually in the deep ocean water itself was 15. So that brings out two points. So one point is just that these ratios are strikingly similar compared to the ratios of other such materials, and it led to a lot of modeling and hypothesis based on the premise that actually plankton are regulating this ratio in deep ocean water, and led to a lot of, you know, interesting models for how very basic stoichiometric constraints can lead to feedback and dynamics and regulation in this recurrent network that is the ecosystem. Right, so this is sort of the premise, and so I'm just going to assume from now that we all understand and we all agree that biology is quickly becoming a quantitative field, and it will require quantitative training for all students, whether they're physicists going into biology and trying to do quantitative biology, or whether they're just very fundamental biologists doing cell molecular biology or neuroscience. All right, so that means that eliminates immediately the questions of why and whether. All right, we're not even asking those questions anymore, but the questions are more like how and when. And I guess the when question, the answer is get them while they're young. And you know, people in finance have observed, so a lot of physicists have gone traditionally into finance to model, you know, market dynamics and try and make lots of money in arbitrage and such schemes. And already people in Wall Street have realized that it's easier to teach a physicist about finance than to teach someone trained in finance about mathematics. Right? So I would submit that the same is also true for biologists. So if we assume that in the future biologists will have to be quantitatively trained, it's better to train them in quantitative methods and techniques and then teach them biology rather than the other way around. All right, so in other words, this I also call the Philip Morris approach. So so if people in Wall Street and the cigarette industry can realize these things, then surely we can too as a community. So I would say that to then bridge this gap, so to bridge the gap between the quantitative side and the more descriptive biological side of things, there are two sort of hurdles to be overcome. So I would say one is what we'd call technical issues, technical competence, and the other is cultural. And these are by no means non-overlapping. These are very overlapping issues. And I would argue actually that overcoming the technical front goes a large way towards overcoming the cultural front. But let's briefly discuss both of these. All right, so so in the get them while they're early approach, I would suggest the following. So just from interactions, I would say one of the biggest things that I suffer from when I give talks in a neurobiology department about some of where I work is not a lack of desire to understand, but it's just a lack of a common language and a lack of common understanding of techniques. And I would say that one of the most fun courses I took actually as an undergraduate was called Mathematical Methods for Physicists. It was based on this book, Arfkin. There are many variants in this course based on many different books. But the general approach is this. It's different sciences have different required toolboxes. And you can take a quantitative, so a lot of the physicists who go into biology now are trained in things like, you know, field theory, and they take a lot of math, often they take group theory and various other things. And those are very important in themselves. And but on the other hand, I think it's really important for a unified language that in the very first year of training, maybe all biologists and physicists interested in doing biology should take the following course. And it should be called Mathematical Methods for Quantitative Biologists. And it should contain at least the following topics, if not more. And so I would suggest that right at the beginning, some concept of order of magnitude. So Rob Phillips talked about just putting numbers on things. And I think that's incredibly important. And it's extremely underappreciated. So just to, you know, he talked about scale bars in the figures and not finding any. And this has been a really common frustration of mine when I look through the experimental literature trying to find quantitative data for my theories. And so just a sense that numbers matter and that you can estimate a lot of things just by order of magnitude. You may not have things down to the finest digit, but you can already say a lot of things once you understand orders of magnitude. So sort of the appreciation that physicists have for order of magnitude estimates, dimensional analysis, and scaling, and just even understanding that quantities have dimensions and dimensions matter is really important. The next tools that I just find indispensable, so I mean I was a math and physics major in undergrad, and I took a lot of mathematics courses, and I also took a lot of linear algebra courses, but unfortunately the math we learned there isn't especially useful in the kind of mathematical biology that I do when I do mathematical biology. And so some of the most useful things that I use day to day are linear algebra, differential equations, and dynamical systems. And if I'm supposed to do this work and communicate it to experimentalists, experimentalists certainly need to know at least roughly what I'm talking about. And so that they can evaluate the quality of my work, or at least decide whether or not they think it's worth listening to. So I think these topics are incredibly important. So as Fourier analysis, or just more generally integral transforms, convolution, correlations, filters, theory, probability. I mean, this is, I guess, something everyone should learn in high school. It's much more important than calculus, in a sense, for people who don't go into science. If they want to understand, you know, medical results and things like that, it's much, much more important than calculus. And of course, in neuroscience, especially coming in from this angle, and Bill, I'm sure, will agree, you know, some concept of methods of information theory. And I think it's really important right at the beginning, if this is going to be like a 2 or 3 semester course, that at least the first semester just emphasize just the general pure mathematical principles of these techniques. Because I would say that examples are important, and I think maybe problems can include, or examples can include biological problems, but for a beginner, it's actually very difficult to separate the specific from the general. And if things are taught right at the beginning from biological examples, then there's a potential for confusion between whether this technique applies to that particular biological example or not. So I would say, I mean, I know that this is, you know, debatable, but I would say in the beginning, certainly devoting at least one semester to just the pure mathematical concepts, devoid of any examples, except in the problem section or example section, is valuable. Because it really enables you to understand the general framework before applying it to problems. But then, the next very important part, of course, is to look at examples and to understand how broadly those mathematical techniques can be used. So here are just some examples of very general qualitative stories that can come out that are really common to a lot of biological systems. So for example, the concept of linear feedback leading to amplification or attenuation of an input and changing the response time with which that system responds to the input. All right, that's a very general principle, and that principle is important whether you're talking about neuroscience, cell biology, ecological networks, anything, right? Social insect colonies, anything, right? Then one can go from linear feedback theory in the context always of these diverse biological examples to maybe nonlinear feedback. Multi-stability, winner take all dynamics in general. So again, these are all phenomena that manifest across all biological systems. And again, involve like things that go from microscopic to macroscopic. Right? Then the concept of stochastic optimization, which is something that we see as a mathematical sort of unifying concept in the theory of evolution, learning in neural networks, bacterial and other slime mold chemotaxis and thermotaxis behaviors and everything. And finally, general things like reaction diffusion equations, Turing instabilities that result in pattern formation and the like. And again, these patterns form in neural networks and in animal, initial cell division cycles and animal development. So basically, and the emphasis should always be, so since we're talking about bridging sort of cultural boundaries and conveying the usefulness of quantitative methods in biology, I think it should also be emphasized when the results that come out of these qualitative sort of principles and these models diverge from expectations that you would have from merely drawing cartoons and arrows. So
you're talking about a graduate level thing.
No, not at all. I'm really talking about
physicists at the beginning of
it. We don't not teach physicists because it's hard. We just don't teach physicists because it's not part of the physics curriculum. Right? It's not like it's so incredibly difficult. I mean, none of this stuff really rests on anything beyond, I mean, this linear, nonlinear feedback theory, it's in principle very simple stuff. It's not, I mean, if students are taking, in the third year of, good physics program, they're taking quantum mechanics.
They're not doing something else. That's
No, that's right. So I am proposing, basically, I mean, I think it's not unrealistic to say that biology is certainly, if you look budget-wise, as a piece of the economic pie for science funding, it's such a large piece of the science budget. Is it unreasonable to think that there should be a whole curriculum devoted specifically to students majoring in a new major called quantitative biology that should include biologists and physicists? And these students are, okay, and also, by the way, this is not excluding the specialization of physics classes. I'm just saying these are going to be, for people who are majoring, say, in quantitative biology, they have to take, say, three courses. So, for example, this course would be one course, right? That would be, say, a second. And these would be courses that were taken in the first 2 years. And there would be requirements, but that certainly leaves a lot of time to take traditional physics courses and so on. And I think there's a value to each biology and physics students taking their own specialized courses as well, because this is not deep enough. That's right. If someone's doing the physics of quantitative biology, they could have,
maybe field theory is
elective,
and they can do this instead, right?
I'm just saying that it's not necessary. I mean, how already some departments have decided not to do classical mechanics in graduate school. For example, when I went to grad school in physics,
you're
I didn't.
Talking about undergraduates. You're telling me
how. I know. I'm just giving an example, and I'm saying why can't you do that on the undergraduate level too? It's just not. I mean, it's not clear to me that.
But you're going to cut out classical mechanics at the undergraduate level.
Perhaps. Yeah, to one. Yeah, it's possible. I mean, why not, right? I mean, certainly.
Where is it in semester?
Well, it's E&M and mechanics, right? This could be in one semester.
You mean below it is a semester?
Right.
Okay, well, maybe we should.
Wow. But I mean, I'm just saying that room can be made for this, right? I mean, certainly as an undergraduate, I took two majors, right? I mean, so certainly I can imagine there being a quantitative biology major that involves these courses. I just can't imagine that it's not possible. Okay, so the emphasis should be in all these examples in these classes that to just point out where these results, even the qualitative results, differ from cartoon models. And that's really important. And so this is a very prescient statement, and it was made in the context of war and foreign politics. But it's, again, another example of where, all these other fields have realized the importance of mathematics, and, we seem to be a little slow in this in our chosen field here. So, it's that... Another advantage of mathematical statement is it's so definite, it might actually be definitely wrong. So, and numerous people have now addressed the value in the last few talks about the value of being wrong. And I think that's something that is certainly underappreciated in biology, but for very real reasons, because in biology, if you're doing an experiment and the controls are difficult, and I certainly know that in neuroscience, certain seminal results like plasticity and networks, those results are actually very hard to reproduce even within the same lab. People have a hard time, and just because they haven't been able to do it again doesn't mean that phenomenon doesn't exist. It just means it's a very difficult experiment to do. So I understand why there's some reluctance to publish results that are negative or wrong. But at the same time, certainly those standards should not be applied to theoretical work in the field. So for theoretical work in quantitative biology, I think there is a very strong value to being wrong, publishing things that are wrong. And that doesn't mean that you can't, right? I mean,
not exclusively,
right? but people should acknowledge there's some value to publish theory that seems interesting and testable yet wrong. So yeah. Yeah, the worst is not even wrong, of course, that's right. So those are qualitative, so for emphasis on like qualitative techniques and qualitative results. And of course, I mean, I think everybody acknowledges that in the end, you know, what we mean by science, or our goal at least, in doing all this stuff, is eventually trying to get actual quantitative agreement. Right, so it is a goal, and it's true in many biological quantitative biology fields. It seems like a remote goal, just because the experiments are themselves not so controlled and quantitative that we can really make such quantitative and detailed theories. But on the other hand, there are some levels on which, just in general, things can be quantified. And I think, you know, I mean, I think Rob Phillips really explained. I mean, a lot of the context in which you can really pin down numbers, quantify things nicely. So I don't have to say too much, but I'm just pointing out that especially in the context of a lab course, this is the perfect place to start to show biology students that things can be quantified already, even though maybe on the systems level that's a remote goal. So the proposal is to start really small but detailed. So start out with biological reagents, talk about stoichiometry, talk about reaction rates, plot trends in biological data and really accurately plot the trends, look at response times, scaling, and so on. Right, so that would come from trying to really fit laboratory data into very basic and fundamental results into some more quantitative framework. And it would also be in trying to discuss the development of a toy model, generate quantitative predictions, and test those quantitative predictions in a lab setting. That would be, I think, at least a valuable cultural bridge to show biology students that this quest for quantitative results actually depends on the interaction of theory and experiment. So send the message of what the ultimate aim is of marrying modeling with biology. So now I'll just get to the more cultural parts. So one thing is that once I think students are taught from a very early level to understand theoretical techniques and quantitative techniques, I think already there'll be a big cultural coming together. But in addition, there's some explicit sort of cultural things that I've encountered as someone moving newly into the field of biology that have sort of just struck me. And the responses of biologists have sort of struck me. And I wish there was something I could do to explain sort of from the physics side my view on things. And I wish they could understand these things a little better. So here's, of course, what we all agree is what we'd like, what we think about, you know, the value of models. And we think that if we could understand a physical process or a biological process on the level of a cartoon, at least saying, well, this A interacts with B, and those two produce C. Well, that's good, because at least that means that we have some understanding of the players involved and how they interact. But then, coming up with the qualitative theory of how they interact and what those interactions could give rise to, that's better. And of course, as I said earlier, we all agree that ultimately the best thing will be to have a detailed quantitative understanding of everything that's going on.
A possible objection to that? Mm-hmm. You know, I generally agree with you, but what I worry about is that maybe by going from the qualitative to the quantitative, or even from the cartoon to the quantitative,
yeah.
we won't say anything enlightening about the biological problem that the biologists don't already understand perfectly well. Like,
that's right.
We're all obsessed with this DNA mechanics thing, but you know, maybe in the end nobody will care because maybe it doesn't matter in any way.
I completely agree. Exactly. Okay, so that's totally right. And sort of the second slide sort of makes a related point, but not exactly the point you're making. So it's that it's true that in some sense, almost most of the value you can get actually maybe out of the theoretical work, maybe the qualitative understanding of what's going on. So the first point is that if there's not sufficient data, so Bruce made the statement about how a lot of the theory has been has not contributed so much to making concrete predictions that can be tested in biology, and it's not, you know, led to really strong interaction between theory and biology. But the comment is, well, it may not predict detailed things about the detailed players, but as Bill pointed out, maybe we don't have an understanding of individual players and the whole dynamics, but we do have an understanding of the basic mathematical computation that's going on in that system, right? And if we don't have the details about the detailed players based on the data, then maybe the best level of description to stay at would be the qualitative understanding. So we don't add in 80 different parameters that we don't have data for, because trying to put those in when we have no understanding of what they're doing is not really an advance in understanding. It just makes everything more muddy. And let me just put this thing. So what Rob was saying is, even without data limits, so even if data is not a limitation, it may be better just to stay the qualitative level of understanding, because sometimes adding detail can more obfuscate the picture. If I have a program to simulate something that's going on that's as big and complex as actual physical or biological system, it's not clear I've made an advance in understanding the system at all.
What would make the case for the full quantitative biology in the biology community at large is adding another arrow which is missing here. Basically, go from quantitative to cartoon.
To cartoon.
If we actually ever use this quantitative data, quantitative model, quantitative hypothesis to actually discover something that biologists did not know before.
I would say that would almost come from the qualitative thing already, right? Because sometimes, I mean, as we know, some players and their interactions, some qualitative interactions between them can lead to a whole new result.
A new cartoon, a new way of thinking about neural transmission.
The channels. That's true. That's a very good point.
Ideally, you'd like to have multiple cartoons and use quantitative data to kill all at once. I think there are plenty of historical examples with exact similar rules of quantitative data.
That's right too, because a priori, there are many cartoons that look good, and often people look at the theory and say, oh, well, you just, as someone said, mathematicalized the cartoon, but you haven't. You've also eliminated a whole class of cartoons, which is...
The end cartoons you forgot about.
Maybe we should go home.
Okay, so this is the last slide. So this is it. So basically then back again, so just continuing on the cultural front, there's some frustrations for a theorist in the field of biology that actually just come from just historical effects, because physicists have a certain publication and peer review and criteria for judging what is good and what is not good research, and biologists have a different set of criteria, and they're both being shaped by their sort of each of their own, you know, recent history and pursuits of questions that they've looked at. But if biology is turning into a more quantitative field, and because physics is an old quantitative field, I would just suggest that maybe physics has had a longer time to sort of come up with a model that's good for evaluating quantitative theories. I mean, just sort of culturally, it sort of developed a system that can evaluate quantitative theories. It's just a suggestion. And so based on sort of the physics criteria for good research and theory, I just propose the following things for judging criteria, for judging sort of quality of work in theoretical biophysics. So in the absence of quantitative data or theory, qualitative predictions are actually good. So it's not something to be frowned at, and I don't think we should be ashamed by it. So even if, you know, a biologist may feel it's not a very detailed model of what's going on, I think there's a value to qualitative predictions. Secondly, theoretical speculation is good if it's consistent, if it's minimal, and if it's based on principles. So if it's consistent with existing data and rests on minimal further assumptions, I think even if it's very speculative in the sense that there's not very much support from the data for the future predictions, it's very valuable to have theoretical speculation. So this might seem like a very obvious statement to make, but it's not, because actually in physics you're allowed to make your own speculations and be wrong and be embarrassed on paper. But in biology, the reviewers decide that their role is to filter out your paper until they agree with all its predictions, rather than let you make speculative predictions of your own.
I mean, I guess my experience in reading biology papers is that they do have sort of theory, especially of the qualitative kind, but only after a body of experimental evidence has been presented and as sort of an opinionated discussion. And
No, but for example, modeling papers are not allowed to be too speculative. So at least in neuroscience, we're allowed to make models of existing data, and that can sort of predict some of the things and maybe go a little beyond in quantifying sort of what's going on, but we're not allowed to say something truly speculative because reviewers will say it's speculative. Even if it's consistent with existing data and it's quite minimal, and they don't point out something flawed with the methodology or with the approach or with the assumptions. They just say, well, we agree with all the above, but the predictions you make are just really have never been tested. Nothing of that sort has been tested, so you shouldn't publish.
You can't do it if you play an open season to speculation.
Well, it's not speculation. It's just if you're trying to model something based on the existing data, and you have some predictions that go beyond anything that's there, and if it's testable, right? As long as it's testable, it's yeah, that's right. As long as it's testable. I'm done.
We've already used the entire topic, so maybe we are.
Okay, sorry.
Move on to this is, you made a lot of fascinating points on relevant online.
Okay.
How copyright is talking about it anyway, even if we use it up, but I think now we should.
Okay, sounds good. Thanks.
So, as usual, you can take another question while he sets up. Yeah.
This is maybe just a comment, much more than a question. I would add another arrow to your chart, your flow chart there. I had semi-quantitative. And I bring that up because I teach biochemistry, and one of the centerpieces of the course I teach is the oxygen transport by hemoglobin, and we use the Hill equation as the approximate representation of hemoglobin's oxygen transport capabilities, and that's actually based on equilibrium oxygen binding data, whereas in reality it's an irreversible process in vivo. And you can learn a lot about the system by semi-quantitative approximations using that semi-quantitative theory. It's not a perfect theory. So I for biology in semi-quantitative applications to problems that can't be solved absolutely quantitatively. Very powerful.
I agree.
Yeah. About 5-year proposals that you didn't think
of? Oh yeah, I was just going to say that for the 5-year proposal, I was just saying that for experimentalists, it could be quite useful to make a 5-year proposal because you buy equipment and it takes that long to set up an experiment, and then you're dedicated to doing a certain set of experiments. So it is reasonable to expect a 5-year proposal. But for theorists, it's neither possible nor desirable to have a 5-year proposal because, I mean, the landscape of the available data changes so quickly. You have to be responsive and work on new data that come out. And it's also true, I mean, I can tell you that if you really ask a theorist, no theorist can honestly say that they could have said 5 years ago that they would be working on whatever they're working on now. So I think it's fundamentally dishonest for theorists to have to write that proposal, and I think it's fundamentally a bad idea to have a proposal.
So we're experimentalists. I don't think they ever did anything 5 years out today. So.